Welcome to New Realities. This is Alan Steinfeld, and each week on this program, I try to bring people to the show who I feel are really at the cutting edge of developing new ideas of how to live in society together and how to evolve the culture to a new way of being. And I think tonight's guest is someone very much involved in the evolution of our social fabric. Her name is Nicole Dadone. She's the founder of One Taste San Francisco and One Taste New York, which is a way of connected living. And she is the author of an upcoming book, and we'll be talking about that, talking about desire, relationship, and how to bring our consciousness to a new way of thinking about who we are. So, Nicole?
Hi, Alan.
Hi. Yeah, I would love to just have a real deep conversation about some of the points that you brought up in your talk last night about connection and desire and relationships. And some of what you said is that we don't know how to have relationships. There's no manual, and you said we think that we're supposed to be good at it, and
right.
And there's no training for it, and we're all totally at a loss for how that's supposed to happen. So,
right.
How do we start from square one?
I think if we begin to look at the same principles that guide, you know, our basic spirituality, relationships were kind of left out of spirituality for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the aesthetic life took over in terms of how we approach spirituality. But if we take the same principles, the same basic principles of connection, and look at how we connect to, you know, spirit, and then we look at that and just apply that to other human beings, I think we have a good foundation to start with.
Actually, it sounds almost like Advaita in the sense that it's all spirit. You know that Hindu philosophy where there is only God here in whatever form it shows up as relationships, as your body, as your mind. It
right.
is all spirit. And
that's how the work that...
Yeah.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No. I was... Go ahead. You go.
Well, that's how the work that I started with, you know, that's the point that I started with, was everything is divine. I had a flash that everything was divine. And then I decided, rather than just, you know, kind of take that on principle, was to put that into practice. And the most challenging, by far, place that I found was relationship, to have the experience of the divine in.
Why is that? Maybe you can go off what we're taught in society, because to show that to make us think that's hard and that's not a place for divinity.
Well, I think, you know, in any philosophy, what you're going to encounter is the idea of attachment or possession is one of the most challenging areas to awaken in. And then, you know, most of how I was taught about relationship, most of the models I had seen for relationship were based on possession. It was like I was supposed to be a half of a person, and then my partner was supposed to be a half of a person. Those two halves were supposed to come together and lock for all time. And it was really important that they stayed locked, because if they didn't, that would mean that I didn't have that other half that I needed, and I would fall over. And so I pretty much learned to hold on at all costs.
Now, did you learn that from your parents? Did you grow up in that kind of household?
I don't know that I learned it so much from my parents as the models that I saw of relationship that were considered successful relationship, like, you know, when people would say, oh, they've been married for 50 years,
mm-hmm.
those models of relationship were very much based on two people being halves coming together.
Right. And we saw that on television. We were programmed. We were fast food fed those images of that ideal couple that was happily ever after
right.
things.
Right.
And it's obvious it didn't work because it's a lot more complex than that. Is that it? Or
right.
Or?
And the referent or the point that we refer to when we look at what a good relationship is security. We've made that the most important thing in a relationship. Well, interestingly, that's one of the biggest challenges in spirituality. In spirituality, you want to recognize that life is dynamic. And what would happen if instead of going for security, we went for dynamic awakening with another human being?
So that's what you're calling perhaps what's a good relationship, something that has dynamic growth and change.
Relationship really is a practice rather than a sanctuary from the world.
Now, how is it a practice? I mean, because you're meeting challenges every moment that and there are always curves being thrown at you, because it's not like a regular practice where, you know, you have to get up and do that posture or say that mantra. It's a practice where the unknown is being thrown in your face every second.
Right. It's the living practice. It's the field where all of your practices culminate, and then you kind of go into play. You see really clearly in present time how well all of your other practices are working. There's no doubt about it in my life. Like the things that come up in, everything comes up in relationship. Jealousy comes up in relationship. Pressure comes up in relationship. Pretending comes up in relationship. All of these elements come up, and then can I maintain, that state of equanimity, that state of clarity?
So you're talking about relationship, but you've also kind of, I would say, mixed up or complicated in a sense where, what you've started are collective livings where 40, 50, there's a bunch of people living together in relationship. And then there's the other side of relationship where it's like, oh, your special partner relationship. So how are you defining relationship? Because it seems like you have both in a sense. Or not.
Yeah, it's one of the things that I think is, I think that those lines naturally blur. Like in nature, there are no boundaries, right? There are seeming boundaries. There are areas where there are dense life forms, but there are no actual boundaries. And I think that that's true in relationship as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we want it to be that there are very stringent boundaries so that we have some feeling of safety or security in this world. But I think when you have that kind of safety, it's a false safety. It's a false security. It's the kind that can break down. And I'd much rather have a dynamic security, and that's, where I have a profound and deep connection with somebody that can also move and shift according to what happens naturally in the relationship.
Right. And there's also, it's a security, but also what some people say, and what I've known, is there's a depth that happens when you're with a partner and you start to, you think along the same thought patterns in a good way. You're evolving together, and there's a deeper connection that you can have with that one person. Not that they're the other half, but it's like, your minds hook up in dynamic ways that makes it very exciting.
Without question.
And that
I'm interested both in horizontal and vertical growth. Depth and width.
And those same types of horizontal and vertical relationships, because, we all have them. We have relationships, with our next-door neighbors or the people we're living with. But there's also a merging of those lines, too, or there could be, or I don't want to say should be, but it would be great if there was,
Yeah, it would be really interesting if, one of the things that happens is I hear a role for a person, like my next-door neighbor, and then I have a set of prescriptions in terms of what I perceive to be acceptable behaviors with that person, right?
Right.
And then what ends up happening is I end up blocking all the natural impulses of my body. So what happens if I'm accidentally turned on by my neighbor? Well, I shut that feeling down and relate as I relate to my neighbor.
Mm.
Go ahead, please.
No, you please tell me what you're interested in.
So what I'm interested in is what would happen if I were to allow all of the impulses in my body to be what dictated my thoughts and behavior rather than my ideas according to the prescription of a role.
Well, see, this is where I want to get to with you, because what you really do have is a radically new vision of a society based on those dynamics, wouldn't you say?
I don't know. Yeah, maybe.
I mean, if we don't have those basic old assumptions about our next door neighbor, about, you know, people in the store, if we break down those roles, those patterns, those boxes we put people in, we start to see them more as whole human beings, and
right,
and everything starts. I think it probably breaks down first before it changes, because you know, you might be turned on by this person or that person and act on that, which is fine. But you know, it's, people have to shift outside of the boxes they've also put themselves in, right?
Right. Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a period where you have to relearn, you know, but as far as I can tell, you know, in yoga, in Buddhism, and in all different forms of spirituality, what we're basically learning is how to be authentic and spontaneous again.
Right.
It's so funny that what we're learning to do is be ourselves. And really what I'm talking about is having relationship from that place.
Yeah, that is so refreshing, and just so I could breathe into that when you actually say that. So I'm not putting a structure on myself in order to relate to anybody. But
right.
but what is this thing, though, about that, you know, special relation? What? Go ahead.
No, what is this thing about special relationships?
Yeah, because it's not a sexual monogamy. What I label it, what I've called it, is emotional monogamy. Okay. You can have sex, and it's probably, you know, it's a stretch for some people, but some people it's not. But it's like, I want your emotions to be with me. I want your, that depth of connection to be. And that's what I think people are more concerned about, that type of monogamy, rather than.
Right.
And so how do we break free of wanting that? Or maybe it's natural to want that, or maybe to have that with everyone. I mean, how do you address that?
I have a few answers. So my first is, one of the things that I've discovered is that awakening is different for everybody. So, for example, for me, I was pretty wild for a long time. And so for me, monogamy is a form of awakening. That's pretty radical in my life. Whereas there are some people who are monogamous out of collapse, because they couldn't imagine any other way to be. What looks best to me is if we all push our edges in terms of learning about ourselves outside of our conditioned behaviors.
Mm-hmm.
And
Go
on, please.
No, I'm listening.
Okay, and then there's this great quote from Alan Watts. Somebody was asking him, he dated a lot of women, and somebody said, well, you know, how do you do that? And he said, well, have you ever read a couple of books at a time? And they said, yeah. And he said, well, you know, I just put a bookmark in, and I picked up where I left off. We have this idea with our either-or mind that either I love you or I love you, but there is no way that I can love both. You know, and in that, I think what we end up doing is really decreasing our potential, you know, and what we actually are telling ourselves again and again and again, that there is scarcity, that, you know, my ability to love is based on scarcity. I can't expand that big. And, I'm not prescribing that anybody be anything at all, just to explore the potential for more.
That's really what I love about your teachings, is because that you are pulling out all the stops and you're saying, let's be as big as we actually are without limits.
Right.
And so when you talk about awakening, what do you mean when you say awakening? What is that for you?
I think the easiest way I can think of it is to step out of my automatic and prescribed behaviors.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a whole list of who I think I should be, who I was told I am, and then there are the natural feelings in my body, and those two very rarely, interestingly, go together. And so I'm learning to follow, you know, a different voice inside of myself and actually take all the theory of who I am and put it into practice and see what works and what doesn't. And I think there's a way that we've just become so afraid of experience. We don't want to make a mistake. And so we're afraid to actually put who we are to the test, and we just keep living out the same ideas.
So how do we put who we are to the test? I mean, because that is such a new concept, and I actually trying to get what you mean. Tell me, because that sounds exciting, but I don't know what it is.
Well, you know, when we have a class, you know, based on exploring desire, for example, and you know, everyone who walks into the class at first is basically mute. You know, it'll be something like, you know, what do you want? And the whole class looks terrified and seized and. Like the first hour and a half is just pulling out what people want. But then you get to a place where all of a sudden people get ignited and you can see the ignition in them. And they're like, oh, and you know, I used to dream about this and I have a crush on this person at work. And, you know, and I'll say like, well, what would happen if you told them?
Mm.
And just the possibility of actually moving forward on, you know, this sort of litany of desire is just unthinkable to people, but one time of doing it transforms people. Just that
yeah.
one time of feeling that ignition, of stepping outside of my own comfort zone, you know, into that dangerous field of desire, it brings life back into my life.
Mm. So your work is really about trying to help people be more human, more themselves, pulling out the...
Right.
That... Yeah, I think another key element, though, is this element of the body and sensation. So we pull out the stops of our personality and we start to express ourselves. And then how does that then relate and integrate into this physical form?
Well, the primary aspect that I found that stopped Huckel was an inability to withstand increased sensation. So there would be, you know, like, you know, I'd see somebody that I got really turned on by, and, oh, my gosh, I couldn't hold that much sensation in my body, so I'd shut it down.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was in this perpetual state of shutting the sensation in my body down, or, you know, just trying to release it as quickly as possible through exercise or something.
Mm-hmm.
And so rather than kind of like feeling a build-up sensation and then releasing it, I learned to cultivate an ability to have increased amounts of sensation. Well, once you do that, you can go anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to be afraid of anything.
Right. And that's so epidemic in our culture, is to shut down the sensation. I mean, I know,
right.
Especially with women, from my perspective, it seems that they,
right.
meeting you and maybe they are turned on or starting to feel, they immediately say no or shut something down, and it's frustrating. It's like, oh, okay. I mean, so, I know you work with people like this, but how do you get them to say okay to sensation?
I mean, slowly and incrementally. and I do what I can to make it clear that the cost of not feeling is much higher than the cost of feeling.
Well, what do you say the cost of... Yeah, go ahead. The cost of not feeling.
The cost of not feeling is greater than the cost of feeling. And I think intuitively, we all know it's true.
Yeah.
And intuitively, we all know that we haven't felt in a long time, and that once we open this thing up, there, you know, it might go haywire. That's usually the fear that, you know, somebody will say like, oh my gosh, but if I open my desire, I'll be totally out of control. I'll be on the street, you know, and... Mm-hmm. Really, what ends up happening, I'll say, you know, like, oh, it's the same as if you haven't eaten in a long time and you go to a banquet, you still only eat one or two plates. It's not like you just keep eating and eating and eating. Your body naturally has a stopping point. It's okay to open it.
Mm. And so why are people so, I mean, it seems like such a natural thing, and it's such a beautiful, it's such a gift of the divine to feel joy, sensation, desire. Why? What happened? Where did we take a wrong turn?
Oh, you know, I mean, you can go, like, to
okay.
the ego. There's so many different places you can go with that. I can say that we have a culture very much based on exalting control and will. And sensation and desire don't tend to operate within that box.
Mm-hmm. And so, like I said to you last night, Ben, okay, so we have the sensation, we have the desire, we have the physical, we have the relationship with each other, which we're pulling out the, so we're pulling out the stops on our physical aliveness. We're pulling out the stops, this is what I'm interpolating from your, you know, philosophy and way, and we're pulling out the stops on our, on our emotional relationships with whoever we encounter, and then how do we then take that to the divine? How do we pull out the stops and whatever that divinity is, or is it encoded in those other forms?
Latter. Belief is we're absolutely, unquestionably constructed of the divine,
mm-hmm.
and that my, you know, a true spiritual journey is one that has me develop enough consciousness, bring enough consciousness to where I'm at to find the divine wherever I am,
mm-hmm.
rather than pulling myself into different environments and circumstances where it's kind of obvious that it's there.
Uh-huh.
But can I go into places where I normally wouldn't see it and find it there? That's the nature of this particular path.
Of your particular path.
Right, right. You know, I think, you know, there's that moment when, you know, and this happens in relationship too, where, you know, your partner's just a jerk, and such a jerk, and all of a sudden they tilt their head in a certain way right in the middle of being a jerk, and you sort of see their beauty again.
Mm.
And I think the same thing can happen in every moment in life where there's darkness and ugliness and hideousness. And then all of a sudden you can see the beauty right in the center of it. And when I can do that, then I can attach my consciousness to that beauty and then burn out everything that's in between. And now that area is lit up.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. And I think that when you work with people, you're doing that as well. So you're lighting,
right.
They're lighting up as you light up in response to that.
Right. And my experience is that nobody ever had long-standing change from being beaten up. They get it from slow, sustained, consistent attention. And then progressively, anybody becomes beautiful.
Mm-hmm. So then where does orgasm, this idea of this peak sensation, fit into the divine? Or is it the absolute point of the divine, orgasm?
Yeah, that's a good question, Alan. For me, in the same way, you know, breath is an expression of the divine. You know, God breathed, and you know, life was brought to earth. I think, you know, we all come from orgasm. Each of us, 6 billion people, come from at least one orgasm. It's a beginning point. It's the alpha and the omega of all things. And everything in between has orgasm woven into it. And if you can find the orgasm, and our definition of orgasm is when two points come together to hold a third, activating the involuntary.
Uh-huh.
If you can find the orgasm in any moment, then you're back at origin. And you're touching divinity directly.
Mm. So divinity actually is the ongoing joy of orgasm, spirituality is the conscious awareness of that.
Right.
So the people who, yeah, go ahead.
And I would add, because I think that what ends up happening is you end up with a belief system that sounds like it's veering only toward joy or bliss, and that it doesn't have the principle of practice in it. And so I think a true spirituality is one that recognizes that balance of going into the profane or the ugly stuff, you know, and then finding beauty in there, that's what deepens your practice. It's not just, you know, sort of like, woohoo, going toward the bliss, yeah, orgasm,
uh-huh.
great.
Right, right, right. So you don't leave anything out of your practice. You look at...
Exactly.
And that's a full life. There's nothing that you encounter that you then just shy away from or don't go there, or I mean, if you do see yourself retreating, there's probably a mechanism, I would guess, in you that says, oh, I'm retreating, what am I retreating from? Is that true?
Exactly.
Uh-huh.
Exactly.
So that's sort of the key, I think, to have that self-awareness, like, oh, okay, what's happening inside me now that I'm reacting this way? And so how can we be more practiced in that practice of that awareness? What's the key for that?
If I were to tell anybody where to start, I would just introduce the idea of approval.
Mm.
Very simply, just approval. And the mind's so funny. I would just put it in there, just as if you can remember in any moment to notice where you're not approving, and then approve. See what happens. And I'm very much of the belief that each person should experience and take it. Approach it scientifically for yourself.
Uh-huh.
But just my experience is that approval has it be that I can penetrate any field.
Uh-huh. So see where you're not approving and switch that.
Right.
But people, go ahead. That's because I think it's the biggest attachment of all. It's what we think we approve of or not approve of.
Yeah. Well, I think... I remember my first experience of having this idea of approval introduced to me, and there were things that I just believed that you could never ever approve of. Like they were just born into the very center of these things. You had to disapprove of them, and I had to shut down. And then I remember this experience one time of just like trying a different viewpoint, and it felt like my whole world turned upside down in that moment. And then it was interesting because it always felt like I didn't have enough. And realizing as soon as I approved of something, that made it mine.
Uh-huh.
I could now connect to it. And then it looked like the whole world was available to me.
Uh-huh. That is a great practice. So what's coming up? Is there anything that you feel like are things you are working towards now? Anything in your awareness that that you're working on along those lines that you'd like to share? What comes up? Just curious where you're adding a practice.
Where I'm having a practice specifically?
Yeah, well, no, what some things you're up against that you're working on or through or with or edges, you're just curious.
Hmm. It's in there deep, but I'm walking this fine edge. So one of the things that I noticed is places that I've kept blocked tend to have this voice of scarcity or victimhood around them.
Mm-hmm.
There's not enough. I'm never going to be taken care of. Ah! So what I'm interested in doing is learning how to penetrate those areas specifically. So I'm looking at any areas in myself where I perceive that I have scarcity and going directly into them.
No, that's good. Now, it takes a lot of courage because most people don't even know where those are because those voices say, I'm hiding, leave me alone, I want to be left alone.
Exactly. It's funny, like they invite such automatic responses. And it's almost like they're so skillful, it's hopeless, it's never going to work out. And so what I'm learning to do is how to meet that voice inside of myself and keep going.
As you're talking, I'm looking around my apartment, and I'm seeing, it's sort of a mess. And it's sort of like a layer of protection I've had over myself to keep myself living in a sort of comfortable, uncomfortable lifestyle situation that I have to kind of crawl through every day almost. And I'm seeing, I don't have to do this anymore. There's something in what you said that just I don't know, I'm saying, oh, I haven't been able to look at my situation in a different way because I've been holding on to the scarcity of having to have it this way. Does that make sense?
Right. Yeah, that makes complete sense to me.
And
yeah.
So I'm seeing in your words, I can try it differently and probably not lose anything in doing that, in facing those darker sides. I can face them and I'm not going to lose any part of myself. As a matter of fact, it's the opposite, you know? It's like, oh, there's more of myself that's been buried under here that I haven't allowed myself to have.
Mm, yeah, that's nicely said.
And so,
my experience is that any time I ever go into my own darkness, what ends up happening, there's, you know, always the fear that I'll never make it out. But when I do, all of that darkness is then converted into fuel. Like, there's this feeling of having gone into darkness, and then, but as soon as I make it out, it's like I have so much more energy. That field is no longer working against me. It's now working with me.
Uh-huh. And there's something, though, about the field where you really have to almost indulge in the darkness to really get it, you know? You have to and then when you get it, it's like, oh, I think I've been here long enough, or this has lived with me long enough, and it's done its job, whatever that's for, and I can let it go.
I love the way you said that. There's, you know, I think there's this false belief of insatiability of darkness. That if you enter it, you'll never make it out. And my experience is that if I actually surrender into it, it holds me for a while, and then it releases me. And when it releases me wholly, and I now never have to go back to that again.
Right. It's like you indulge the addiction. That was one thing. You indulge. If you're addicted to cigarettes, you smoke. You let yourself smoke without any guilt. You just stuff cigarettes down your throat. And then at some point, or whatever the addiction is, I think it's like, okay, we've all given ourselves permission to have it. And then,
Right, because I think addiction works in that, precisely in that, it's an area where there is no consciousness and it just keeps spinning and spinning and spinning. So the moment that you introduce consciousness in it, you've already started defeating the addiction.
Right. So
I do think, like, if you're going to smoke, then do it consciously. Begin to just really notice how the smoke feels in your body. Begin to notice what the feeling and texture and shape of your craving is. Like, actually build a relationship with it. And when you build a relationship with it, this thing that's sort of this demon that's been in your body begins to dissolve. It dissolves in the light of your awareness.
Uh-huh.
There's this great Rilke quote. Perhaps all of our dragons are just princesses, helpless, waiting for help from us. I think all the demons in our body are that way. They're just waiting for us to really, really put our consciousness on them. And as soon as we do, then they become beautiful. Like at the core of smoking, for example. It's a lot of what people have to replace a feeling of not having love.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's an at one point in their lives, it was an elegant solution for something they were lacking.
Mm-hmm. That's good. Oh, I think what you also said about what you said last night at your lecture about always having a relationship. You never lose relationships. So even these addictions that. There's still a relationship to it, but the thing itself has changed. So you've owned, let's say, the wisdom of that experience, and it's always with you.
Right. Yeah, I made a decision at one point in my life. I just wanted to be friends with my life.
Explain that a little bit.
I was so tired of fighting with everything. I was so tired with fighting with who I thought I should be as compared to who I was and putting those two parts of me at war constantly. And I finally just said, forget it, you know. I'm going to be your friend. I'm going to actually confront every part of myself in a friendly way and see what happens. And it's amazing because then the pieces actually begin to move into alignment. And when they move into alignment, it's a kind of bliss, you know. In Kabbalah, they say the messianic age will come when the mind and the heart move in unison.
So you start to become friends with your life as opposed to fighting and resisting your life.
Right, or renouncing any part of it. You know, I come from a sort of a renunciate belief system, and I realized that was just so harsh on these really tender parts of myself. There is no evil in me.
Uh-huh.
There's just darkness that isn't yet aware.
Uh-huh. And so are you still finding a few spots of darkness? I mean, are you surprised when you said, oh...
Well, you know, I had a great teacher once, and I was saying to her, oh, you go through sort of depression and sadness with such grace, and I'm so messy, and I hope someday I never have sadness. And she said, I hope that for the rest of your life you do, so that you get to explore and inquire, you know, and be alive. You know, there's this way that we think that problems, you know, that someday all of our problems will go. Well, that would be really boring.
So that's a false kind of spiritual dogma of the, you know, enlightenment or the new age. It's like, oh, everything is fine and perfect. And what you're saying is true spirituality is living life, whatever that brings you, into that fullest sensation.
Exactly. Well, what I'm saying is everything is fine and perfect, including all of the problems.
Uh-huh. Or not even seeing them as problems. They're, can some people say they're opportunities?
Yeah, but they're, come on, Alan, there are times when they're problems.
I know that. I was trying to be a little spiritual there.
Levels of my consciousness where it absolutely perceives what's happening as a problem.
Yeah.
And so I'm friends with that part of my consciousness. Like, I won't say, like, oh, no, it's not a problem, Nicole. Like, it really is a problem.
Right. No, okay, thank you. Right. And I'm sure. Okay, you mean it's not just an opportunity to learn?
Yeah, right.
Well, I know, I mean, but yeah, but you know, you, I understand what you're saying, and it is, and it's also what you were saying is that yes, it is all a great opportunity. So I get that too, but and you know, there's the reality of it too. But you were sort of saying that way, in a good way, you know, in a airy fairy spiritual way. But you were saying, wow, there's a place, and because whatever does confront us as a problem is. It is something, I guess. I mean, I don't know. I can't think of anything at this moment.
But. Well, you know, there's this traditions talk about this idea of a human being a community of selves. And many traditions then say that you should have the community of selves all unite, and that's the ultimate practice. I'm of the belief that there are many voices that run through this being. And there's a way that if something feels really bad,
uh-huh.
I actually want it to feel really bad.
Why
I want
that?
To feel it. Well, you know, if everything is divine, right?
Yeah.
I want to feel it exactly as it comes. I want to know every single note in this life, every single feeling, every single bit of it that I can possibly absorb and live into. I want to live. And so I want to know, you know, my heartaches, oh my gosh, the depth and texture and flavor of some of the heartaches I've had, they're beautiful. Now, you know, at the time they weren't, but that's, so I have all of that that shapes me, so I have lots of rich texture in my life. That's how I want to live.
That is beautiful. And that's the capacity for every human being, if they would only know it, if they and that's your destiny. I mean, that's who you are. That's what I mean. Bringing that out in other people is what what your mission, let's say, it seems. Is that true? Would you say that?
Yeah, my desire is to have everybody have access to every response available and be able to play the right response in any moment.
Whatever that is. And response
right.
is that. And I think as we evolve as a culture, there's going to be responses that are fresh and new and haven't been defined.
Yes.
And that's exciting. Not everything that can be experienced has been experienced. There are dreams that still yet to dream, let's say. Or as George Bush says, the future will be better tomorrow.
How interesting, yeah.
I know. I mean, poor guy didn't know what he was saying, but, you know, I think there is some truth in that.
No, it's beautiful, yeah.
And so I get that. So these many voices, and we can talk a little bit about your book that's coming up, but the many voices is also reflected in how you're choosing to live in community, because these many voices are all parts of ourselves, in a sense, and we're here to deal with it full on. Is that the purpose of living in the communities that you've created?
Well, I think there's a few reasons. I mean, the primary model that I took from was the Zen Center. That was where I was moving into when I started different communities. And the idea is that it's really challenging to awaken alone.
Mm.
You know, and the monks hold a practice so that people can come in and take as much as they want and immerse as much as they want. And, you know, I was incredibly blessed. I had 5 teachers for 3 years, you know, just with their attention on me. And so I got to have that experience of a tremendous amount of attention. You know, as you're awakening, you feel like you're going nuts.
Uh-huh.
And so to be held while you go through it so that you don't withdraw from the experience, you know, it uh-huh. takes a lot of work to really open a practice. Uh-huh. And then you come up against something hard and want to run. And so the idea of community is a group of people who can really hold each other, who are all committed to their own practices,
uh-huh.
and so they're committed to each other.
Okay, because I didn't get that. I mean, I've been around the One Taste In and Out, but I didn't get, and now I'm getting that it's about awakening, that the communities that you've created are about awakening, and I think awakening to what you just said, the capacity to feel.
Right.
And so, but I think the tendency sometimes, and I don't know what you can do, but is people become a little automatic in their practice. And how do you point out to some people that maybe they're being, you know, not as conscious as they could? Not that I'm any person to say what was this, but, you know, how do you suggest that so it doesn't become automatic?
I you know, it's funny. I have a friend who had another friend who was a monk in Burma, and they were together in Burma, and one said, oh, my practice wasn't very good today. I couldn't catch my thoughts at the point of generation. And my friend laughed at him and said, do you realize how deep we must be? Most people don't even notice these things.
Mm.
Don't even notice, you know, if you catch your thought at the point of generation. And I think that I think it can seem, you know, like it's automatic or it's not working at different points. But, you know, there is no way that you can live in community automatically.
Uh-huh.
You just can't. You bump into yourself all over the place. And there can be ways that you shut down, put up walls, but those walls are just waiting to be dissolved.
Uh-huh.
And I also feel that anybody who's ever said they're on a spiritual path or they're on a journey or whatever language they use, it may seem like they aren't at given points, but
uh-huh.
that seed's been planted. People don't say those things by accident. It's planted. It'll do its job. All I need to do is, if they want somebody to witness them, is to be there and put my attention on them.
So the point of these your communities is this awakening to the aliveness of who they are in relationship, in sensation, and in the divine creation. Is that the overriding precept, let's say?
I think it's a place to test the theory that we're constructed of the divine.
Uh-huh.
To put that theory really to the test in some of the most challenging areas.
And radical. I mean, I don't think there's been, a practice along these kinds of lines that you've created where this is so strongly on the physical, let's say, but also as it's connected to emotional quality and to turn that on its head and say, this is divine, makes it quite unique and exciting.
Yeah. There are those people who can't quite fit into the box. And I definitely was one of those people who had a pretty, I had a background of being a good spiritual person, but it just wasn't getting me there. It didn't seem, it wasn't authentic. And
yeah.
So there's got to be almost like, a lot of the best students in our schools aren't succeeding because our schools aren't geared toward, creativity and
uh-huh.
and experiential learning. I think the same is true for, there are some really beautiful, beautiful spiritual traditions out there, and I'd love to see more emphasis on experiential divinity. So that it's not theoretical, so that it can go anywhere.
So then let me ask you just I think you are really feeling being and you feel people, and then, so what, how do you know divinity is real? What is divinity in terms of sensation? I mean, because when you say divinity, I think, no sensation. So how do you define divinity in terms of that?
That's a good question.
Or maybe, like it sort of said in the beginning, the Advaita way is divinity is just as much sensation as sitting in meditation.
Oh, without question.
Uh-huh.
Without question. I think they're all different levels of abstraction of divinity, and it's, on every level of abstraction, I feel like I've had a moment of recognizing it there, like, oh my gosh, you're here too, just these little tiny flashes that make up this life.
When you say that, like those flashes, is it a place where you drop into you just get the big picture of wholeness, of oneness? Is that how you would
right.
say it? I see.
Yeah,
so,
wherever you go, I think people have some kind of definition that divinity is unity, divinity is one,
mm-hmm.
and can you experience that everywhere is the question.
Well, I guess the big paradox is here you are the body feeling sensation, and then you also want to dissolve into. I mean, there are points probably where Nicole Dadone dissolves into the oneness, and yet there's still the sensation of bringing you back into a singularity, or is that not true? I think there's a place that maybe the two kind of join when you drop into total sensation. Maybe you are everything. I don't know. What's your experience?
My experience, I like this idea of Jacob's ladder or breath. It's an inhale and an exhale. And I had a Zen teacher once who said that somebody was saying they were so afraid they were going to lose their identity. And she said, you don't have to worry. Identity pops up quickly enough. And so that's kind of how I look at it. It's like, oh, it's this wave of divinity, the experience.
Uh-huh.
And so it is, it's those exalted, peak, gorgeous, pristine moments of unity and complete loss of identity. And then it's deep, concentrated, frustrated, walking on cement in the middle of New York City. That's it, too.
Yeah. Well, I really enjoyed talking to you, hearing you speak, and I think it seems like over the last year, I guess I've only known you about a year, it's like there's a softening and an opening and an expansion into new parts of yourself.
Yeah, there it is.
And so, just what's the name of your book that's coming out?
It's called White Hot Path.
White Hot Path.
Uh-huh.
Okay, and it's going to be coming out in August?
August 18th is the release date.
Where can people find that book?
Well, I'm not sure yet. I'd have to talk to my publisher.
Well, it'll probably be on your website.
The One Taste website.
OneTaste.us?
Right, OneTaste.us.
That's the main website, onetaste.us.
Right,
well,
exactly, yeah.
Well, I look forward to having more dialogues, and it wasn't so bad, was it?
It was one, you know, I love talking to you.
Yeah. We have a relationship. It's and it's exciting and dynamic for me. And thank you thank you for being just yourself and encountering people to engage them and being themselves. And I think you're coming out more and more, and as you dissolve into something bigger, it's like something deeper gets freed up to also be engaged. Well, let's do more.
Okay, I'm in.
And you'll be back in New York when?
In about 2 weeks.
In about 2 weeks to do another course.
Right.
Great.
No, I'm going to come back. I think I'm going to be lecturing in the city.
Oh,
so that'll be on the One Taste website as well.
Oh, good. Yeah, I can put you out in a bit. I think we should do some big lectures here in New York.
Okay, great. Yeah, I had a great time doing the last one with you.
Yeah. Oh, that was good. Yeah, that was sort of a kickoff, wasn't it? Into a whole new. We'll do some more. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, Nicole.
Okay. Thanks so much, Alan.
Okay. I've been talking to Nicole. And your website, onetaste.us, right? That's the best way
to get onetaste.us.
Which One Taste is a great organization, really bringing together community here in New York and in San Francisco. And I recommend going to their website, checking out Nicole's courses. I will also have a table at the Yoga Expo coming up in New York, sharing that with One Taste. And I'm promoting the Charles Muir workshop that's happening on the 13th, 14th, and 15th. You could email me at newrealities@earthlink.net. This is Alan Steinfeld. Also check my website, newrealities.com. And I look forward to hearing from people about the interviews. I also have a podcast page on newrealities.com. And I'm just queuing up this closing song, which is called The Song of the Soul by Chris Williamson. Thank you for listening. This is Alan Steinfeld. And look forward to hearing from you soon, and listen next week, same time.
$5,000 per week take you? Discover the exact details of a simple and proven system that quickly puts $5,000 to $10,000 in many students' pockets every week. What's most amazing is that there are almost no computer skills required, and you can start pulling in cash automatically within just a few hours. We are absolutely convinced that our proven system will create massive wealth for virtually anyone, and we'll prove it. Go to bbscashflow.com now and get all the details. That's bbscashflow.com.